about it. I mean, what he said is correct. It can and does kill you. But when you think about how people can live with AIDS now, they can live a long, healthy life. You know, it's not early on in the disease when really we didn't know how to treat it. So food for thought, you know, whether it's a chronic disease or not. But I found that interesting. So a little bit of history. HIV, really in most of our lifetime, some of you probably weren't alive in 81, but really it's a fairly new virus. Pretty much was starting to be seen. People were sick in around 1981, California, New York. It was mostly homosexual men, IV drug abusers at that time. Around 82 is when the CDC gave it a name. 85 was really when the virus was identified, the HIV virus. That's also when a test was implemented for our blood supply. And then in 87 was when we started getting some of the antiretrovirals coming in. So I can remember when they showed in that first section with the big, you know, outfits on. You know, I can remember, I was working back then, and I can remember totally suiting, gowning up with everything that you could put on just to carry a tray into a room. And the patient was in, you know, like double isolation, and, you know, I still remember the guy's name. I remember the first guy that I ever took care of. I can remember his name. I can still see his face. You know, and really, you were not in the room. Even just to walk in and get something and walk back out, even if you weren't touching it, you had everything on. Because we didn't know back then, you know, what was going on. So, you know, to say it was scary, I've lived it, I can remember. You know, and before the blood was tested, I had a friend actually who got it from a blood transfusion. And then before she really even knew, she had two babies and transferred it to both of her kids. She's died now because that was back in 86. So, you know, a lot of people that, you know, nurses that are around now, you can ask them, what do they remember from back then? And it's, you know, in our lifetime, this has come and developed. So, you know, it's not been around that long, and we're still learning, which is really, you know, that's always the good thing. And I think we're only getting better, and like I said, people can live now with it. So, AIDS, acquired immunodeficiency syndrome, is when HIV takes over your body and makes you immunocompromised so that your body cannot fight off the virus of HIV. So, some of the things that have been said, people say, it's okay to isolate HIV-positive patients. What do you think? No, not anymore, right? In the past, that's how it's been. It's acceptable to reveal the HIV status of a patient to their spouse or close relatives. No, just like with anything else. An HIV-positive woman should not have a baby. What do you think about that? Now, you can have a healthy baby with the treatments that we have now, with a woman that's under treatment. People who get HIV through sex deserve it because of their behavior. If HIV testing is available, then doctors have the right to test patients. This is a hot topic. You know, you have patients that come into the hospital, and should they have to reveal if they're HIV positive? You're the nurse taking care of them. Do you have the right to know? The doctors are going in doing surgery. Do they have the right to know? The law is now the patient does not have to disclose. So that's, you know, these are all interesting food for thought. So it's widespread. You know, I'm sure there are many of you in this room that may know someone or know someone who knows someone that's either been affected or infected with the virus. So some statistics, millions, 1.2 million right now in the U.S., and this is just in the United States. A fifth of that number are unaware that they are even HIV positive. Since the AIDS diagnosis, over 1 million people have been diagnosed. And you can go on, this is one of the things, you can go on this AIDS clock, and It's pretty neat. It shows you, you know, some different statistics. You can put it to your area where you live, look at other areas on the globe in the United States. So it's an interesting thing if you want to click on there when you're looking. So here's the global number of people living with HIV. So in 2009, it was around 30 million globally, which is crazy when you think about that. And here's another, this website here, if you want anything, AIDS, this is really good for information. I'm pretty sure I have this on the Webleography. I have some really good websites on the Webleography for this section. And again, here's some of the estimates. 34 million in 2010. Proportion of adults living with AIDS who were women, 50 million, 50%. Children, newly infected, and AIDS deaths, 1.8 million AIDS deaths. And these are global numbers. So, HIV, human immunodeficiency virus, what is it? It's a molecule that's called a retrovirus. So it's called a retrovirus because its genetic material is on a single strand of RNA, which is different than our genetic material, which is a double-stranded DNA. So that's why it's called a retrovirus. The way that HIV gets into your bloodstream, it's the guy on the first thing, he said it's a little bit difficult, and if you look at the one of the last slides that I have, which shows you the intricacy of how it gets in there and what it has to do. It does seem a little complicated, but somehow it's getting in there. What it does is the HIV molecule, it has these glycoproteins. So when it comes into the host, it has to enter the host somewhere, right? So that's either a break in your skin, mucous membranes with sex, IV needle abusers, you know, however it's going to get into your body is the first thing that it does. And then the virus binds to these glycoproteins on the CD4 cell. I think I have a different slide. Well, that one's not that much different. But the virus will bind to the CD4 cell. The viral envelope then goes away and it lets the virus get into your CD4 cell, which is your helper cell, and I'll talk about that in a little bit. So it attaches, it gets into your own human CD4 cell, and then using an enzyme called reverse transcriptase, there's three enzymes essentially in the HIV viral molecule. It's reverse transcriptase, protease, and what's the third one? I forget what the third one is. It's in my slides. I'll think of it as I'm moving along. So as it gets in there, this reverse transcriptase actually tells the RNA to change itself into DNA. So it makes it like it's your own DNA. Changes itself into this double strand of a DNA. So usually, the medications, there are meds that are reverse transcriptase, they're nucleoside reverse transcriptase inhibitors. They work in that area. So all the HIV meds work at different steps of this replication. Okay? So this reverse transcriptase is needed. It changes the RNA of the HIV into the host cell DNA. So now it's in there and your cell thinks that it's the correct thing to be there, essentially. It looks like your own cell. And it starts to replicate. It goes into this big, long strand. Protease is actually, like, they call it cleavage. Protease snips pieces off of this strand, which then goes out and reattaches to other CD4 cells. So essentially your CD4, which is one of your lymphocytes, now it's infected with the HIV molecule, but your body thinks it's the same because the genetic material inside looks the same. And it goes out and replicates all over again. So there's here's like a little, you know, of where it's coming in, whoops, there it's getting in. The reverse transcriptase, essentially, see how it's, this is your own DNA here. So it kind of is making itself look like what you already have. Changing around, and it will branch off, a piece will branch off, and then start all over again. Yeah, it unwinds and it makes it into this long single piece, and then the protease, actually what it does is protease snips, that's why I say it gets like really complicated. Protease snips like two ends, which is like sticky, and then those two ends can go and attach again somewhere else. So yeah, it seems like it's a complicated thing. But it's pretty interesting when you really look at it. And that's called replication, how it replicates. So now, your CD4 cells, which are usually your helper cells in your body, now they're HIV factories. Because now they're just replicating all over the place and making all these new HIV virus particles. 10 billion viral particles can be made in a day. It just is going crazy. That's where the meds come in, and we'll talk about that at each different stage. There are entry inhibitors, so which will affect that viral envelope from being disintegrated. You know, when the HIV initially gets into the CD4, that's where the entry inhibitors start. So there's a lot of, the meds all work at different stages, kind of like antibiotics, if you know how an antibiotic works, or any other medication. They work at the different stages of the replication. So CD4, what's a CD4 cell? Your CD4, you'll hear it called a T cell, CD4 cells, they're all the same thing. It's a type of lymphocyte, and there's two types. You have your CD4 and your CD8. The CD4 is your helper cell. This is like the leader of the band. The CD4 tells the rest of your immune system what to do. They're the, what do you call it, the conductor. They lead the attack against infection. So you get an infection in your body, your CD4 cells essentially go out and try to ward off your infections. The T8s are your suppressor cells. So they're there to kind of tell the CD4s when to stop, so you don't have this over-raging immune system. They put an end to the immune response. They are also helpers with cancer cells. They're killer cells. They help fight cancer. So there's specific cell proteins on the cell surface. That's why I said these glycoproteins. You have to have these glycoproteins on your CD4, and then they connect with your, the HIV has those proteins as well, and they attach. And that's how the molecule kind of gets together with your CD4 to begin with. So the HIV, again, it'll infect your CD4. In a nutshell, it puts the RNA into there, which then changes to DNA, and it's able to multiply and make copies of the HIV. So if you're being tested, how's that test reported? So when you're infected with HIV, at some point your CD4 cell, they're going to decrease because the HIV molecule is essentially changing all the good ones into an HIV molecule. So your CD4 count goes down. Your helper cells go down. So that's a sign of a weakened immune system and will lead to the opportunistic infections, which we'll talk about later on. The way it's reported in cubic millimeters of blood. So a normal CD4 is about 500 to 1600, and you'll see some different numbers in different resources, but essentially that's a normal CD4 count. An HIV patient, literally it can drop to zero. So the lower your CD4, the worse you are, the less chance you have to fight infection. Your CD8, that count is a little bit lower, and your ratio should be like 2 to 1. You should have two CD4 to 1 CD8. Patients that are being tested, the values can fluctuate, especially if it's a different time of day, if you're under any stress, if you're sick. So patients that are being, you know, when they're watching their CD4 count, you typically should go about the same time of day, and obviously if you're sick, you would report that. Because different vaccines cause different numbers. The better number to report is the percentage of your CD4 compared to your total lymphocytes. It's a more stable reporting number. So normally it's like a 20 to 40%. In HIV, usually there's more CD8 than there is with your CD4. So, what do the numbers mean? A CD4 is a good measure of your health, of your immune system. You have plenty of helper cells, fighter cells out there to fight infection. The lower the number, the more damage that's done by the HIV molecule. So that's not the only thing that they look at for HIV. So you want to know, all right, now we know that our good fighter cells are low, but we want to know how many HIV molecules are in there as well. That's going to tell us how sick we are with the virus, essentially. And that's called a viral load. And the viral load, this will tell you also when certain drug therapies should be started. So your CD4 count is the number of helper cells, and again, the higher the better with that, the lower means you're immunocompromised. With the viral load, the higher, that's the more virus that you have in your blood. So there's two different tests that can be done for that. The PCR and the branched DNA. Now there are two different tests. They're reported differently, different numbers, so you can't do one test one time and another test the next time and necessarily compare them. They're both fruits, but one's an apple and one's an orange. So if you're going to do an exam, you would do a consistent test. And again, it's reported as copies of HIV. It's how many HIV copies are in your blood. And now we can measure as few as five copies. Years ago, you had to have like 100,000 copies of HIV before we could ever measure it. But now it'll measure up to 1.5 million copies. And it's per milliliter of blood is the way this is measured. But now it's so sensitive that it can detect as few as 5 copies. So the best report that you would have for a viral load is undetectable. Right? That would be the best thing. However, that doesn't necessarily mean that you aren't infectious. It just means that it's not being detected right now. And really, early in the disease of HIV, you could have, early on, you typically have a high viral load, but you may not even have an HIV antibody yet. We'll talk about the antibody tests, because your body didn't have time to make the antibodies yet. So you could be infectious. There's a window period where you're infectious, but you may not even show that you have the antibody yet. So how's the viral load test used? Basically, it detects the virus in the blood before the antibodies. So we use it with the CD4 count. So if your CD4 is going down, and the viral load is up. It helps to predict your health. If you have a high viral load, obviously you're a little bit sicker than if your viral load is kept low. And it helps to manage your therapy. If you're on the antiretroviral drugs, it tells your physicians if they're working. Usually what they want to see is they want to see your viral load increase by 90% within 2 months when you start your medication treatment. And hopefully you're going to decrease down to less than 50 copies. So this exam helps to manage your therapy. So what do the numbers mean? The way it's written, it's powers of 10, so they call it a log change, is what you'll see written. And it's really how many zeros are behind the 1. So like a log of 5 would be 10,000 copies. And that's the way it's reported. That's the way, so if you see log, it's log 2 would be 100, you know, so on. So it's how many zeros are behind the 1. The CDC recommends that if your viral load is greater than 30,000, that you start treatment with the antiretrovirals. And again, even if your viral load is undetectable, you can still pass HIV on to another person. Which essentially is saying, you know, what if you are diagnosed with HIV, even if your viral load, say you're lucky enough that your viral load is undetectable, you can still transmit the disease. Once you have it, you have it. And really, only 2% of all the HIV in your body is in your blood. It's in other tissues as well. Lymph nodes, spleen, brain, but you can't measure it. The only place you can measure it is in your blood. So, HIV reproduction. You get the CD4 cell, it's activated. The HIV now is starting to replicate. You have all these new HIV cells out there, which is destroying your good CD4 cells. HIV is in the plasma, and the patient's getting sicker. You can have a latency period, which is where it's slowly replicating. So your viral load may be low. It's called clinical latency. And really, patients that are newly diagnosed, they may be essentially symptom-free 7 to 10 years, that you can go without having any HIV symptoms, any illnesses related to HIV. So with medication, if somebody's diagnosed and treat it early and keeps themselves healthy, they can have a pretty decently high CD4 count, a low viral load, right? That's what you want. You want your helper CD4s up, you want the virus cells down, and you can live like that. The average is, I think, it's around 8, so like 7 to 10 years, that is pretty much how you can go. But then you may get sick, you may get an infection. So the infection is going to trigger your CD4s to increase, which then may trigger the HIV to start increasing itself. So often infection or some kind of stimulation of the immune system is going to trigger more replication and you start getting sick. So usually 80-90% of patients with HIV will start to show symptoms. And we'll talk about some of the illnesses that you get. So when you don't have any symptoms, your chances of the opportunistic infections are lower because you're healthier. So what are the most common modes of transmission? Unprotected sex with an infected partner, sharing a needle. Now in 2012, really transmission from mother to fetus is a lot lessened if the mother is being treated. So if the mother is healthy and being treated, it's a low risk. And also infection from blood products, because we developed the test for blood products. So that's a low risk also to get it from that. But really back in the beginning, that was common. It's transmitted through a variety of body fluids, serum, semen, vaginal secretions, amniotic fluid, breast milk. And the longer the virus is around, the more strains there are. And the strains are always getting resistant to the medications that we have. So So the higher your viral load, the easier it is to transmit the disease. Anal intercourse is a transmission route. Heterosexual transmission is on the rise. And it looks like if you look on some of the CDC sites, it's infected male to non-infected female is on the rise. The IV drug abusers, and it's either IV or intradermal. The repeated exposure really is what shows that will heighten your transmission. Your blood products, the window that I was talking about, you can be infected and your body did not create the antibodies yet. So you may get tested and you don't have any HIV antibodies, so it looks like you're negative. If you donate blood at that time, you can transmit it. That's why if you donate blood, they ask a ton of questions. So somebody that, you know, is a high-risk person or thinks that they may have been exposed is better off not to donate blood. Because even if they say, oh, I was just tested, you know, I get tested every 6 months. If you are in any type of high-risk activity or a high-risk person, you're better off not to donate because there is that window period where you don't know if you are. So this is sad. I can't make you sick. So testing, what do we do? How do you test? Basically, the diagnosis is based on history, okay? What kind of either high-risk behavior or what happened that you think you may have been infected? Where were you exposed? When was that time? What are your risk factors? Doing a physical exam, the lab evidence of your immune dysfunction. So we're going to draw some lab tests that I'll talk about. If you have any of the HIV antibodies, signs and symptoms, and then there's a diagnosis based on a CDC classification system. And what that does is it classifies you based on your CD4 count, specifically your numbers, your viral counts, and then there's different clinical conditions that put you either in category A, B, or C, and we'll talk about those. So when you first get infected, when I'm talking about the window, you know, it takes a little while, 3 weeks to a few months to create antibodies. So that's when that window period is. It's the period between the infection and the antibody production. So category A, and they all go A1, 2, 3, B1, 2, 3, and C1, 2, 3. And the A, B, and C, I mean, it's a little, A, B, and C is based on some of the infections, some of the opportunistic infections that you have, your signs and symptoms. The 1, 2, and 3 are based on your CD4 count. So A is if your CD4, A1 it would be, your CD4 is greater than 500. So the way the 1, 2, and 3 goes, and you don't need to memorize these numbers. I mean, you should have a general idea of, you know, like obviously the lower CD4 is the worst, but you don't need to memorize the numbers. But a 1 is greater than 500, a CD4 greater than 500. 2 is between 200 and 499, and then a 3 is less than 200. So even if you're in class A, category A, but if your CD4 is less than 200, you have the diagnosis of AIDS. Once your CD4 drops below 200, then you're no longer only HIV, you have the diagnosis of AIDS. And then you don't ever go back. You know, once you've dropped and say then your CD4 count goes up again, your diagnosis of AIDS remains. You don't go back, oh, well, I don't have AIDS anymore, I'm only HIV positive. Once you have the diagnosis, you keep the diagnosis. So category A, greater than or equal to 500, you really don't have any symptoms of the infection. You may have some generalized lymphadenopathy, It's the acute infection, so you're newly infected with an illness or just newly infected. And you do not have conditions from B or C, which I will show you what those conditions are. So essentially, you're pretty healthy, okay, for the most part. Really no signs and symptoms. So B, you're starting to have some symptoms now. So your CD4 is between 200 and 499. And you have a condition for category B, which that's my next slide. Or you have a condition that the clinical course is complicated by an HIV infection, like shingles, something like, you know, something that if you were a normal, healthy person, you would be able to battle that. So if your course of your illness is complicated because you have the HIV virus, that is also one of the conditions for category B. So all of these, and I'm not going to read every one, but it's these conditions plus. These aren't the only ones, but these are the main ones. So thrush, pelvic inflammatory disease, herpes, and they're very specific if you have two or more episodes in the same dermatome. Fever or diarrhea lasting for more than a month. ITP. So these are all the conditions in category B. So if a patient has a CD4 between 200 and 499 and one of these conditions, then you are in category B. So C, yeah.
This may be a stupid question, but if your CD4 drops below 200 and you're diagnosed as having AIDS, that diagnosis doesn't change, but can your classification change from A to C?
Yes, your classification is pretty much based on your symptoms.
Okay.
Yeah, but your diagnosis then of having the AIDS virus stays.
Yeah.
So category C is you have AIDS. You've now moved from HIV to AIDS when you're in category C. Your CD4 count's less than 200. And this category is associated with high mortality, morbidity, lots of opportunistic infections. And they always take the lowest CD4 count. That's what I'm saying, how it doesn't really go back. Once you drop, your diagnosis doesn't leave you. You don't lose that AIDS diagnosis. And really, a diagnosis of AIDS, you know, gets you certain treatments. There's some disability, some governmental assistance that you can get. So that's why it's all pretty, you know, straightforward how they classify things. It offers you different entitlements, food stamps and, you know, different things like that. So it's pretty objective. You know, it's not a wishy-washy thing of how they classify this. So here are some, I mean, this is a couple of slides worth, but these are some of the category C, which are your AIDS indicator conditions. These are all mostly the opportunistic infections. So back, some of the big ones, the pneumocystis pneumonia, that's one of the biggest ones. Cervical carcinoma, cytomegalovirus, Kaposi sarcoma. So this is just a beginning of a list. And then here's some other one, the Mycobacterium tuberculosis, toxoplasmosis of the brain, wasting syndrome. And I'm going to go over some of these in a little bit more detail. So testing patients, how do they find out that they have the HIV virus? To find the antibodies, I keep wanting to say antibiotics. To find the antibodies, the ELISA is the one that you'll probably hear. That's kind of the one that you hear of, but it's really the EIA now, the enzyme immunoassay test. So that will look at the antibodies. That's usually one of the first ones that they'll do. I think it's the least expensive. The western lot. And then the IFA, which they look under a microscope. The radio immunoprecipitation, actually they, there's radioactive isotopes which connect to the viral particles, and they can see that, to the antibodies. And if you have two of these tests that are positive, your chance of having a false negative is pretty low. The Western blot is pretty much the most accurate. The ELISA is very specific, or it's very sensitive, so sometimes there's false positives with that. Because it is so sensitive, it will pick up other antibodies. So usually they do two exams. And that's why I said if you have two of them, your chance that it's a false positive on both is pretty low. And then the tracking tests to look at your viral loads are the PCR and the branched DNA. Those are looking at your viral loads. And then they can look at your immune status. How's your immune system working? Is it functioning well? No, they can look at your CD4 and your CD8s and the ratios. So, like I said in the beginning, they can look at the number, they can look at the percent of CD4 to your normal lymphocytes, and then the ratio. It should be 2-1, but usually in HIV it's flipped for the CD4 to CD8. So Oprah got tested because in Africa, you know, 5.4 million people are infected with the HIV virus. When she opened her school, she, you know, obviously she didn't tell her status, and she was not going to expect her students to necessarily share theirs either, but she wanted them to know. So how do you interpret a positive result? Positive is that you have the antibodies to the HIV. So you're infected and you've now produced the antibodies. The HIV is active in your blood, so you should assume you can transmit. You don't necessarily have AIDS. You might not even have a symptom of anything. You might not get AIDS, because the way that we can treat in this day and age, you can live a long, healthy life with HIV and really not move into AIDS, but you are not immune. A negative result. If you get a negative result, does that mean that you do not have HIV? Not necessarily, because of that window period. It just means that you don't have any antibodies at this time. Maybe the virus hasn't been in your body long enough to produce the antibodies. So you've either not been infected or you just haven't produced the antibodies. So if you have a negative result and you have a reason to suspect that you're exposed, you're typically retested 3 months, then 6 months. And you should continue to take any precautions if you have the suspicion, because again, you could be positive and just not know it. And usually, like I said before, once you have that positive, you typically will do a second exam to confirm. And there really is no definitive test to say that you absolutely do not have it. Really what you're looking for is to see if you have it. There's not something that can say, nope, you're definitely negative. So you get the HIV in there, you seroconvert, you're positive, you could be asymptomatic, again, long time, years, 7 to 10 years is typical, and then symptoms could come. So counseling, when patients are tested, this was always a big, how do people get tested? Is it always anonymous? Do they need to be given the results in person? Essentially, confidentiality is the key. And this comes from the CDC, this, these guidelines here. What you want to do is obtain informed consent, and I'm going to talk about some of the legal acts that were formed all around HIV testing. The test should be voluntary. You shouldn't force anybody or coerce anybody to take an HIV test. Patients should understand in their own language, if they are being tested, they should understand what the test is, how it works, how HIV is transmitted, and what their positive or negative results would mean. Right? Because you don't want them to just get a test and then they find out they're negative and they don't have that counseling to say, no, you need to come back. So they really should be educated. Different states have different laws about how they report. They even have different laws about how the testing is, whether it's by your name or whether it's by a code number. So each different state has different laws about that. You should also provide services that are appropriate for the person's age, their developmental level, their language. And then give them high quality service. There should be protocols for if they are positive, now what do you do? What kind of treatment is offered for them? This is back from 05, but most states have name-based reporting. Philadelphia, for a short period of time, they didn't want to use names. They wanted to use codes. So they tried to get that where, and they did for a short period of time, but it was found that they couldn't, the CDC couldn't necessarily track if somebody just came in and was given a code number, because then there wasn't enough information to actually find that patient or to keep track of that patient, because they didn't use names. They didn't have birth dates in. So it really ended up being cumbersome. So most states now have a name-based system. Even though it is still confidential, the way that they gather the data, the way that the CDC gathers the data is by your name. So in 1988, this Act 148 really came in about the confidentiality of HIV. What it said at that time was, you have to ask for an HIV test, you have to give your consent in writing in order to give your blood. Negative or positive result, you had to come in and be given those results in person. And you had to have counseling before the test and after the test. Then in 2011, Act 59 came along and made amendments saying that really an HIV test can be an opt-out. So you may go, in for some procedure and in with all that stuff that you sign and they should tell you or you should read, it's that they're going to give you an HIV test unless you opt out, unless you say, I do not want it. You don't need the written informed consent anymore, but you still need informed consent, which is the patient should know if they're in an opt out, or they should know if they are saying, yes, they want an HIV test. And the nurse, can say, yes, the person has given informed consent, but it's not necessarily like, a sheet of paper, I'm giving my consent for an HIV test. To give a negative result anymore, you don't need to meet face-to-face. That can be given over the phone. But positive still needs to be face-to-face. Katrina?
When I was doing the nursing supervisor thing up at Lehigh Valley, one of the nurses had a needle stick.
Mm-hmm.
And they ended up having to go into the room and have him sign for an HIV test so she could get one done. What would have happened if he didn't sign it? Could they have still run his blood to do the test?
Mm-hmm.
No?
No. No. You have to hope that the patient will do it. No. And usually then they'll just follow, they'll follow the person who got the stick. But yeah, the patient still has to consent. And counseling before the HIV test isn't required anymore. So again, it has to be explained to you. But the counseling itself isn't. So this guy here, I guess he had unprotected sex with two women, knew that he was HIV positive, and he was charged with aggravated sexual assault. And this is, I'm not going to run this one. This would, maybe we have time. Let's see. Yeah, this one is. All right. be. You can live with that for many years and be healthy. You take care of yourself, follow your drug regimen. And then at times, you know, when the time comes when your CD4 count drops, you may turn your, the HIV may turn into AIDS. And typically, here's kind of how it progresses. See how your CD4 count goes down, your viral load is going up, and it's usually over years of living with the disease turns into AIDS. So some of the manifestations, how do you know, how do we know, what are some of those manifestations that we talked about that were on that screen? The AIDS indicator categories. They're the opportunistic infections. So they're usually bacteria, fungus, the viral infections, the cancers, and then there's conditions that are specific to HIV disease, which is encephalopathy and the wasting syndrome, HIV wasting syndrome. So opportunistic infections, they're caused by germs that are all around. Those of us that are healthy walking around, we either have these in us already, or we can be exposed to them and our body can fight them off. The patient with HIV, especially if they're, when their CD4 counts drop, their body can't fight the infections off anymore. So that's why they're opportunistic. They're kind of around anyway, but they take the opportunity to attack the HIV patient. Bacterial infections are typically the easiest ones to treat. Viruses are the more difficult. And often this is a secondary, a comeback disease from something that you already had. For example, like I said, the shingles. So if you've had chicken pox as a child and now the shingles is going to come back, you know, and really run rampant because now you have HIV. And as time goes on with an HIV patient moving into the AIDS diagnosis, often they get more difficult to treat. So some of the common ones, and I'm going to go through most of them kind of piece by piece, but the bacterial pneumonia, TB, the salmonellosis, the Mycobacterium avium, the fungals, the candidiasis, histoplasmosis, some of the protozoals, the virals, the CMV, the herpes. And then in the United States, the most common is the pneumocystis, thrush, CMV, and the infections caused by the Mycobacterium avium complex. So Mycobacterium tuberculosis, so what is that? It's a common bacteria, it's airborne. We all know about TB, right? But in this country, for the most part, it's not a major thing. We have good treatment for it. It's nosocomial. It can be spread in the hospital. This usually precedes the AIDS diagnosis. Patients, when they get into an AIDS, when they get the AIDS diagnosis, they should be tested yearly. When you're active with it, there's three different categories that you can have of the Mycobacterium TB. The constitutional is you may just have the fever, the chills, weight loss. Pulmonary category is you're coughing. And then the extrapulmonary, actually the bacteria is in your lymph nodes, it can be in your bones, other organs in your body, and it can run rampant and cause you issues in whatever organ it's in. So here's some, like it's in the lymph nodes, this is in the back and the spine here. So that's the extrapulmonary, where the bacteria is destroying this patient's body. Typically the treatment for TB are drugs that you've heard of, INH, rifampin, and they're usually on them at least for 9 months. The problem is, when the patients don't take their drug regimen the way that they should, and then the disease actually becomes resistant. So there is a multiple drug resistant TB. And it's essentially, it's results from the patient not properly following the drug regimen. With these patients, this directly observed therapy, this is a big thing, and especially in community health, public health, this direct observed therapy. Literally, they either go out to a patient's home or the patient has to go somewhere every day if that's when they need to take their pill, and they need to be watched. Literally, the pill has to, they watch them take the pill. Down the throat, open the mouth, did it go down? Because that's how bad it gets when the patients don't take their medications. So the follow-up care for this is that they're really watching their symptoms, trying to take care of their symptoms, and trying to increase the compliance to prevent the reoccurrence for the patient, because every time it comes back, it's worse, and then you don't want to spread it. So if you think that a patient has this, obviously they're in a reverse airflow room, they should be for respiratory isolation until their sputums are negative. So Mycobacterium avium complex, this is another respiratory infection. It's usually environmentally acquired. You get it from soil, from unpasteurized dairy products, animals, eggs. You can't necessarily pass it to anyone else, but this is a common bacteria in HIV AIDS patients. It's easier to prevent it than to treat it. And the lower your CD4 count, which this makes sense with all of these, the lower your CD4, the higher your chance of getting any of these. Some of the symptoms, and really the symptoms for many of these are all going to be the same. That's why sometimes it's hard to diagnose which is which. Fever, night sweats, that would all be the same for the TB, right? That's your signs and symptoms of TB. Fatigue, anorexia, abdominal pain. The side effects of the medications for this are bad, so really they try and prevent it to begin with, and then they treat based on the signs and symptoms. You try and manage the symptoms and try and get them to be compliant with their antibiotics. Salmonellosis. There was just a thing on about these turtles again, and I have one of these dreaded things in my house. The thing, and I hear, once I, my kid got it, I hear they live for like 20 years or something. So if anybody wants one, I keep wanting to like let it outside. Have chicken or something, I don't know. My neighbor has a pond, so I wanted to put it in the pond. Anyway. But you can get salmonella from the turtles, so... you know, in some of these diseases, it's prevention for the most part. So an AIDS patient would not be handling one of those dreaded little things. Ingestion of contaminated foods, all right? We've all heard, you know, on the news, salmonella from, I don't know, what was the peanut butter? Is that salmonella? That's the most recent one. The peanut butter, and then it's in all these other things because the peanut stuff, you know, is in cookies and all kinds of things. Handling of contaminated feces, food handlers, and again, kind of the same sign and symptom. Nausea, fatigue, anorexia, night sweats. Treat with antibiotics, symptom management, and try and prevent the breakdown of the perianal region, especially from the diarrhea. So for the most part, you're treating the symptoms. With a lot of these, you're really treating the symptoms. Bacterial pneumonia, common with IV drug users. So an increased incidence with the needle sharing, alcohol use, smoking, strep pneumonia and H flu are two of the biggies with this. And again, if your CD4 count is less than 200, you're at increased risk. They will culture out the bacteria and give you an antibiotic specifically to whatever your culture is going to show you. And for this, you're really going to try and, again, prevent it. So you're going to try and do teaching to the patient about better behaviors so that they don't pick up the bacterial pneumonia. Candida is this, a fungal. Commonly found in soil, food, mouth, vagina, large intestine, and again, all of us have it, but whether it overtakes your body, you know, that's what happens with the opportunistic infections. Signs and symptoms really depend on where you have it. So if it's in your mouth, the patient may have dysphagia, they might not want to eat, their throat's sore, it hurts them. Cutaneous lesions, intertrigo is like chafing in the folds of your skin. So if you have it, you know, especially if you would have a heavier person that has more folds, you have to take good care to keep the folds clean. You can have it vaginitis. And then it can really just be throughout your whole body, and then you would need IV antifungals. So your treatment is site-dependent. So the clotrimazole, trochus, those are essentially lozenges. Nystatin, you've probably all even used that, like a swish and spit. You're going to teach them routine skin and mouth care. And a little bit of prevention may be some yogurt with the live cultures that might help to prevent it. Help a recurrent infection. So this is what it looks like. The white, if you've ever. Have all of you seen it? Candida in the mouth, thrush in the mouth? Babies get it too, so anybody that's had a baby, it's kind of frequent. This poor little guy, but it's all over him. And you can imagine that's, you know, think trying to give him something, a bottle or something to drink, it's probably going to hurt. Cryptococcosis is a fungal. It's from pigeons, usually from like where pigeons nest, and actually it gets into the air and then you inhale it. Smokers are at higher risk, obviously if your CD4 count is low. And it actually gives you not only infection of your lungs, but it actually can go to your brain and kind of sit in there also. So it can give you CNS symptoms, temps, fatigue, headache, altered mental status, and then also your lung issues, dyspnea, lesions. Amphotericin B is the big treatment here. And often they will be on a lifetime suppressive therapy. So they will be on an antifungal pretty much forever, not to get it back again. And really all of these drugs, this is going to be, they all sound like a broken record. I mean, many of them have the same symptoms, and many of them, the treatment is really the same. It's the antibiotic, the antifungal, antiviral, whatever you're going to do. And then you're treating the symptoms, and you're also trying to help the patient to be compliant with their drug therapy. Because you can imagine, now, you know, they're on all their meds for their AIDS, which I'm sure is, you know, and there's a regimen that you have to keep. And now they have to be on more medication for these opportunistic infections that are coming. So it's life-changing. So here's some of the cryptococcosis, what it can look like if it gets all over. Histoplasmosis. This is more typical certain parts of the U.S., middle central states, Puerto Rico, and again, it's soil enriched with bird droppings. So it is more common with HIV people who live in those areas. Again, signs and symptoms are pretty much, you know, similar to the others. Enlarged liver and spleen, abdominal pain, oral lesions, and the treatment. Ampho-B, fluconazole, and again, these patients will also be on lifetime suppression. So this one, it's, you know, the bird droppings again, and the spores kind of get into the lungs and then they go into the bloodstream. Yeah.
Oh, I think I just answered your question. So this is people with HIV or with AIDS?
These conditions are AIDS defining. So if you had HIV and then you get one of these infections, you are then you move into the AIDS category. Okay? So this is kind of how this works, you know, bats or birds or whatever. Here's your, like, where the incidence is. So you breathe the spores in and essentially can give you, you know, lung, gets into your blood system, into your lymph system. Bad news. Yes?
So these conditions are defining.
These are AIDS defining.
Regardless of your CD4 count, or is it assuming that if you get one of these infections, your CD4 is going to be below 200?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, typically, if you're healthy, you're going to fight it off for the most part.
Okay.
Coccidioidomycosis. Again, we don't live in this area, so, you know, at least that's good. Valley fever, this is nickname. If it's outside of this area, and I think I have a slide that shows you, the patient either traveled there or grew up there. It really, if you've never been to the area, you typically won't get this. And it's another fungal infection with the same type symptoms, same type antifungals, and again, the lifetime suppressive therapy. So this is the area here, the valley. Especially where the darkened area is, that's where it's mostly common. So pneumocystis, this is the most common opportunistic. This one, depending where you look, it used to be classified as a protozoal. It really is a fungal, but it doesn't act like a fungal. So you may look at it some places and it may say protozoa, but it's really a fungal, but it doesn't, antifungals do not work on it. So this is kind of strange to actually classify. If you look on the CDC, I think they classify it as a fungal. And it's Pneumocystis carinii, but it has, again, it's been newly named to this Yirovici. So now you'll see P. Yirovici, and it's the same thing as what the Pneumocystis carinii. They're the same thing, they just renamed it. But it's airborne. You know, it's around, it's in a lot of us, and it's reactivated in AIDS patients. So PCP pneumonia, it's the most common opportunistic, like I said, and cough is really the first sign and symptom. And it goes from a nice easy cough to they get very, very sick with it. Dyspnea on exertion, and again, CD4 counts low. It can leave your lungs and actually get into your eyes, your lymph nodes, your heart. And some of the big, they try, like I said, these fungals, but they typically, they'll have combination regimens with these. Corticosteroids have been tried. So there's a nice normal lung with the darkness and then the little infiltrating patches of infection there with the pneumocystis. Toxoplasmosis. This one is why pregnant women should not clean out the litter box. It comes from cat feces. or ingestion of food, bad food, you can get it from pork, lamb, veggies. And again, your risk is higher when your CD4 count is low. The signs and symptoms with this are a lot of CNS symptoms. So ataxia, the patient might have some mental confusion, vision loss, cranial nerve palsy. So if you're doing a cranial nerve exam, motor problems can lead to seizures. There's all the different meds that they're going to use. Xylan, obviously, if the patient is having an issue with seizures, they're going to give them suppressive therapy. Cryptosporidiosis. Again, this is found in mammals, birds, reptiles, contaminated food. See a pattern here? Contaminated swimming pools. Normally, if you get this, your body fights it off. If you're a healthy person, your body will fight it off. HIV patients, this is a chronic thing that they will continue to have. Signs and symptoms, they'll be dehydrated, lots of diarrhea with this infection, like liters worth in a day. So obviously your nursing care is really focusing around monitoring their fluid and their electrolyte status, their nutritional status, because they have huge amounts of diarrhea, abdominal pain, and a lot of electrolyte imbalances because of all that diarrhea. There's really not any good treatment for this one. You may give medications to slow down their peristalsis, but often it's going to focus around nursing care with the fluid electrolyte imbalances and the nutritional imbalances from the diarrhea and their skin. Keep their skin intact. And this is a hard disease because what you can imagine, if you have liters worth of diarrhea in a day, how are you functioning in your life? You know, you can't even really go anywhere because you constantly have to go to the bathroom. So, a lot of social isolation with this one. Isosporiasis, this is from the Isospora belli, and it's a parasite from infected animals, contaminated water. Again, signs and symptoms, diarrhea, anorexia, weight loss, TMP sulfa, that's a common med with many of these. And usually you can treat this, and this one you don't necessarily need the lifetime suppression. You can treat it, they can get over it, and, kind of move on. CMV is a virus, cytomegalovirus. It's pretty much all over the world, and many people have it. It's just if you're healthy, you can fight it off. Bless you. But you get this from direct contact with infected secretions, saliva, cervical secretions. You can be asymptomatic. If it gets into your eyes, the chorioretinitis, you can actually go blind from it. And this ganciclovir, that's one of the big medications with this. All of these meds have big side effects. That one is big with neutropenia. Anybody ever see the movie Philadelphia with Tom Hanks? He had the CMV retinitis. He started to go blind from that. And this you usually do need the lifetime suppressive therapy. Yeah, if you haven't seen that movie, I don't know when it's from now. I mean, it had to be from the early 90s, I would think. But it's worth a watch. It's sad, but it's a good movie.
Who's Tom Hanks?
Herpes simplex. Again, many people get fever blisters. You get them, they go away, they're good. HIV, you're going to keep getting it, especially in the same dermatome. They're painful. They can be all over, orally, genital, perianal. can move to encephalitis, bronchitis. You get herpes Whitlow, which is on your fingers. Acyclovir is the most common treatment of herpes. And this can be chronic, come back, you know, constantly. These patients also can be on lifetime suppression in order to keep the virus in check. So there's a painful, if you've ever had a good big fever blister, they hurt, they're painful. There they are all over his legs. Okay, PML, progressive multifocal leukoencephalopathy disease. This is the JC virus, and that it's JC, it's somebody's name, whoever, I guess, identified the virus. It's a CNS disorder, it's a demyelinating CNS disorder. So you're going to have a lot of CNS symptoms, ataxia, the cognitive impairment, some vision. This can progress to dementia and death. There's really no good treatment. They try prednisone for the swelling, the anti-inflammatory effects, acyclovir, and really it's just keeping the patient comfortable. This hairy leukoplakia, this is, it's kind of like candida, like a thrush almost, but it has little fingery things on it, little hair-like projections. So again, painful, it's on the tongue. So you think, now here's a patient that should be trying to keep their nutrition up because you're trying to keep them as healthy as possible, and they have all this stuff going on. So they think this is caused from a virus, and it's usually one of the first symptoms. So there it is. These are hard to see, but little white things on there. So the neoplasms, the cancers that are pretty specific to AIDS. HIV patients have a higher incidence of these cancers than other people. And HIV stimulating the cancer cells, your immune system being lowered, and then the HIV kind of stimulates the cancer cells to overtake and to grow. So Kaposi sarcoma, non-Hodgkin's, and invasive cervical are three of the AIDS-defining cancers. Kaposi's is the most common that you'll see. Again, these are AIDS-defining. So if you have HIV and get any one of these cancers, you will move into an AIDS category. So Kaposi sarcoma, it's a malignancy of the endothelial cells. It's in the lining of your blood vessels. There's actually four types, but three of them aren't related to AIDS. So the classic Kaposi is typical in elderly black men of Mediterranean descent. There's an African and then transplant patients. And then there's the HIV related, which pretty much is all over the body. This is the most common AIDS malignancy, like I said, predominantly seen in homosexual men. And more, this is being seen even without low CD4 counts. Remember, I told you, if your CD4 drops and you're given the AIDS diagnosis, you can get healthy again where your CD4 may go up. You still have AIDS if you have Kaposi's, and they're starting to see it more with people with higher CD4 counts. They don't necessarily know why. And it can occur early in an HIV infection. So usually you just start with like a little lesion. Yeah?
What happens if, will it always, could you just get to be with my CD4 count? Well, could you be in like category D and get sarcoma and then that'll be then? You know what I mean?
If you're in B, yeah.
So that
because if you have any of those, it's AIDS defining.
Okay.
But your CD4 count should be less than 200 at some point, though.
Okay.
Yeah, and it does get confusing. It's just once you have the diagnosis, And once you have any of those AIDS defining things, so it's a CD4 count less than 200 and BOCES, which gives you the C category, which is the AIDS category.
Okay.
So you start with just a little patch. It looks like a bruise. But then really it pretty much can be anywhere on your body. Often it's on their face, on their back. They can treat it with radiation. There's some chemo that they can give that, you know, makes it a little bit less dark, the way that the, if you've ever seen them, they're pretty specific. Eventually, it's, you know, like many cancers, eventually it just kind of overtakes and you can't treat it anymore. Here's some of the, that's what it looks like on the back. And there's on this guy's face. So here's after, you know, with some chemo. It got a little bit less after the chemo. So it's a cancer of your blood vessel wall. So it's, you know, going to disturb, I mean, you know, blood vessels everywhere, so it can disturb anywhere. So non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, another one. Usually late in the course of HIV. This one is related. It usually goes hand in hand with low CD4s. Primary sites can be brain, GI. Initially, your signs and symptoms aren't really specific, but again, kind of the same as the other ones, fever, night sweats, weight loss. They've had some success with methotrexate and cristine. The prognosis for this is poor if patients get this. Invasive cervical cancer. Joel, I was thinking of you. This is the only disease that we've talked about that really women are worse with HIV. Women typically get sicker with HIV and have more opportunistic infections than men. This is the only one that we've talked about this whole semester that women are worse. So anyway, invasive cervical cancer, high incidence in HIV women. It progresses more rapidly, and it's less responsive to treatment. So early on, you may have a positive pap smear. That might be the only symptom that you have. You may have some bleeding after intercourse, blood tinge discharge. As it progresses, they have a lot of pain, a lot of pelvic pain, back pain, their legs, lymphadenopathy, and really their legs swell up a lot, huge amount of edema. You can do some radiation, hysterectomy, and try and prevent metastatic CA. So, what do you think? Chronic illness? Not a death sentence? What do you think? I don't know, reading all this stuff is scary, right? Everything that's going to happen, so. All right. HIV encephalopathy, or it's called also AIDS dementia. It's really your central nervous system is overtaken. There's typically three things that go on. So you'll have cognitive changes, your judgment, your thinking is slower, motor, so your walking may start to be affected, ataxia, you're just a little bit more clumsy than you were before. And then behavior changes. You might be a little bit more anxious than you've ever been before, manic, or you could be apathetic, social withdrawal, irritable. So three different things. It's the cognitive, the motor, and the behavior. Typically, this is more in the very young or the very old, patients that are anemic. Patients whose weight is very low, and this does progress more quickly in women. Some success with the zidovudine, the AZT, but there's really no specific therapy. For the most part, you're supporting the patient. Without treatment, it's a 3 to 6 month survival. This very quickly can kill you. The meds, again, the AZT, the meds that they give, they have their own side effects. So biggie with this is the neutropenia. So you're going to monitor the side effects from the therapy. You're going to try and help the patient to remain independent despite all the issues that they're having. HIV wasting is another HIV-specific condition. So most HIV patients are going to lose weight. So how do they know which is documented HIV wasting? You have to lose greater than 10% of your baseline weight. So just because somebody says, oh, I lost, you know, 10 pounds, that doesn't necessarily mean that they have HIV wasting, because you have to know what they weighed to begin with to know if that's greater than 10%. So that's the key. Usually greater than 10% of your baseline plus diarrhea, weakness, or fever. Chronic diarrhea, weakness, or fever with the weight loss. So again, these people, yeah, do you have a question?
Yeah, what period of time is that over? Like, I know you said from their baseline, like since they were diagnosed with HIV, or do you know what I mean?
I don't know if there's a time. I don't know if there's a time frame.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't know that, if there's a certain specific, it has to be. When you look at the definitions, they don't give a time. It just says greater than 10% body weight loss with those other things, with the diarrhea and the weakness.
Okay.
So if you don't have diarrhea, weakness, or fever, if you lose weight, it won't necessarily be the wasting. Okay. So obviously your food intake is going to be decreased. You may get oral lesions. And typically the degree of wasting is going to correlate with your degree of AIDS, how ill you are. You know, how low is your CD4? How high is your viral load? Essentially, you have to determine the cause. You know, is the patient not eating because they have herpes and they have, you know, lesions or candida in their mouth? So you have to figure out why they're not eating, why they're losing all this weight, and then try and treat that. Usually once wasting begins, it's hard to stop it, but you want to stimulate the appetite because you want the patient to gain some weight. You're going to try and get their lean muscle mass. You don't necessarily want them to gain fat. You want them to gain some lean muscle mass. And some of the oxandrolone, the anabolic steroid, Megace, appetite stimulant, those have been found to help. And then you're going to monitor for factors that may interfere with the plan of care. So if they have cognitive impairment, they may not want, they may not follow the diet regimen that you're trying to put them on. There's a poor little guy wasting away from others. Okay, so the drugs. Let's talk about the drugs. So the nucleoside reverse transcriptase inhibitors. These, think back to when the HIV gets into the CD4 and it uses that reverse transcriptase to change the RNA into the DNA. This is where these, the top two drugs are going to come in. They incorporate themselves into the DNA of the virus, so then it stops the virus from building. So that replication of RNA into DNA can't be complete, so that it can't create a new virus. So these stop at the reverse transcriptase spot. Same with the non-nucleoside reverse transcriptase inhibitors. They bind directly to that enzyme, the reverse transcriptase. They bind to that, and then they prevent the RNA from converting to DNA. And then protease inhibitors. The protease is that last stage. Remember I told you that it's called cleavage. The stage is called cleavage, where the protease is actually clipping some of that single-strand DNA. These protease inhibitors, they prevent the HIV from actually from clipping and being assembled and released, which is the last stage. So again, they're all affecting the replication. Trying to keep, if you think back on that first YouTube, where you had your HIV molecules, and when you use this antiretrovirals, what they're trying to do is keep that HIV from multiplying. The fusion entry inhibitors and the integrase inhibitors, these are both new. They're fairly new drugs. But the entry inhibitor is kind of self-explanatory. It's supposedly, you know, it's to block entry into the host cell. It's supposed to protect the CD4 so that the HIV can't get in there, can't replicate. And then the integrase inhibitors blocks the enzyme, that's the other enzyme, the integrase integrates the genetic material from the HIV into the CD4 cell. So an integrase inhibitor prevents that step of the replication. So they all come in at different times. So these are some of the common names. So, you know, you should know, you know, generally the medications, you know what their side effects are for the patients. What lab work are you watching when patients are on these medications? So these are some of the common ones of the NRTIs. Here's some of the NNRTIs. And again, there's new ones every day, new meds, because there's new strains of HIV constantly. That's why even if you have two HIV patients, they should still practice safe sex. Because you could have one strain, strain A, let's say, and your partner has strain B. And you may be, you know, doing okay with your med regimen with strain A, but now, you know, unprotected sex or whatever, so now this other strain can get in and infect you with another strain, so you're going to get sick. So now your retrovirals that were working now are not going to work because it's a whole different strain. So even two HIV people still have to be safe and try not to transmit. And these, they all do, but these even more specifically have to be taken exactly, like exactly at the right time, exactly as prescribed. Because when these are not taken this way, there's a huge incidence then of the drug-resistant strains come about. Here's some of the protease inhibitors. Today, mostly HIV people have, it's called HARP treatment. It's the highly active antiretroviral therapy. Didn't you have a patient in this summer, right? The one with this therapy? And basically what it is, it's a combination. It's a combo of the different meds. So you have a combo of the protease inhibitors with the NRTIs. Really, there's no single drug therapy for the most part, because they're trying to hit that virus, the replication of it, at all different stages, right? Trying to hit it at the entry level, when the reverse transcriptase is trying to change the DNA, you know, before the DNA starts getting snipped around. So all the different stages, so that's what the drugs are doing. And this is the thing I was telling you about. Take a look at that on your own. I'm not going to run it. It's kind of, you know, it uses a lot of the enzymes and this G22, but it's pretty interesting, and it really shows you how the virus attaches to the CD4, the viral envelope releases, gets in there, the reverse transcriptase changes the RNA to the DNA, integrates into the DNA cell. So it's a pretty good, you know, to sit and watch how it goes. So HARP, highly active antiretroviral therapy, this is really the key right now, and it's multiple different drug therapies. So the goal, obviously, you want to suppress the viral load as much as you can. You want to restore and preserve as much of the immune system as you possibly can for these people so that you can improve their quality of life. The drugs, though, they all have side effects. You want to give medications that have the minimal drug-drug interactions. And that's the case also, not only with the antiretrovirals, but also then if you have to give an antibiotic or an antifungal, you really have to look, because all of those opportunistic infections that we just talked about, those meds actually interact with these and can cause a lot of side effects too. Sometimes the side effects are worse than the actual disease. And you're trying to reduce morbidity and mortality. So the goal of therapy, you're trying to get one log decrease in 2 months. So one log is like 1-0, right? Like a tenfold decrease. Really, you would love to see no detectable virus in 4 to 6 months. So that's less than 50 copies. And remember, no detectable virus does not mean that you're free and clear. You're still infected. If the patients are compliant with their medications, if you have a patient, you know they're doing, you know, taking the meds at the right time, taking them all the way you told them, and they are failing, if their viral load is not coming down, you'll change the med regime. Because if they're, now it's different, if they're not compliant, then maybe you just have to try and get them to be more compliant before you would switch it around. And they have to continually watch for drug resistance and always educate the patients. So treatment, you have to involve the patient. Obviously, this is a huge commitment on the patient's part. You know, if they're taking medications more than once a day, it's really, they have to be, you know, oh, I took my meds 2 hours late. Like, no, they have to be very compliant with, you know, how they're going to take their meds and when. The patient should really know what their numbers mean. What does a CD4 count mean? What does their viral load mean? And I think that many patients with HIV or with other diseases, it's, you know, the patients that are more educated tend to do better because they, you know, they pay more attention. They have to be able to accept the treatment because, again, it's probably not easy if you have to sit and take a whole bunch of pills. And then educate them on their responsibilities and let them know what their prognosis is based on their numbers. You have to have the family involved, involve community, say it's a person that doesn't drive and they can't get to get their medications, involve the community to try and get them out to get their pills, the church. They have to have knowledge of their diagnosis. The dosing strategies, you want to try and use the simplest option. So if there's an option that a patient can take, you know, once a day as opposed to 3 times a day, that's what you're going to do. Because you're going to have better compliance. You can give them pill boxes, you know, Sunday through Saturday pill boxes so that they know if they took it. Electronic reminders. And the cost of meds, you can imagine, are, I'm sure, like out of this world. These are some of the companies, drug companies, that will assist with meds if the patient can't afford it. Ryan White, how many of you have heard of Ryan White? All right, about half of you. The younger ones won't. He got HIV in 1984 from a blood transfusion. He was a hemophiliac. And he was actually kicked out of school. He was kicked out of middle school because he was HIV positive. So you think back in 84, 85, it was really scary. We didn't really know what it was all about. Him and his mom, they were on the news all the time. He died in 1990. He was 19 when he died. Probably if he would get it now, he would live to be, an older man, hopefully. But anyway, a lot of funding comes from his foundation. Huge, huge foundation of help for people with AIDS. Nutritional therapy with these patients. Obviously, this is a huge concern because you're trying to keep them healthy. So any patient, right, healing, health, nutrition, so this kind of goes without saying. You're going to teach them when they should seek referral, like remember, if they're having diarrhea, if they start losing a lot of weight. Help them with the side effects of their medications. If they need to time their meds according to the pills that they're taking, if there's any, meds that interact with food. Teach them about supplements, if they should be taking their supplements, but not big mega doses of the vitamins. If they have sores in their mouth, you can give them liquid supplements. Sanitation, this is, this talks to like a lot of the opportunistic infections we were talking about, food handling. Even being around sick people because you can't fight off. So really it's a whole different way of life for these patients. When you're shopping, go get your canned stuff first, your frozen second. You don't want to go get your meat and your milk first and then do a 2-hour shopping trip and, even have the remote chance that something is going to grow, on the chicken that you got like an hour or so ago. You're going to be really careful with your food preparation and with the food that you keep in the fridge. I'm sure, these people learn to go through it really quickly. When in doubt, throw it out. Because they don't want to, a little bout of food poisoning for a healthy person is okay, but these patients are going to have the opportunistic infections come in. Eating out, you're going to eat at a reputable restaurant. Although anymore, you can get, it's so scary. I mean, just with this peanut butter thing, and reputable restaurants have things too. So I'm sure it's scary if you're in this situation. So you're going to educate in the basics of nutrition. You're going to treat weight loss early. Educate them on their food drug interactions, and if they have any issues that are causing them to, not be able to take in nutrition, you're going to try and support them through. Development of an AIDS vaccine, is it right around the corner? No, I don't know that it's right around the corner. There have been a lot of vaccines, though, that are being tested. Right around the corner, I'm not too sure about that, but they are working on it every day. So, obviously, emotional, ethical issues with this disease are huge. I would like to believe it's getting better, but I know, and some of you may have, if you've taken care of an HIV-positive person, I think it really causes you to, look at your own ideas of what you think. Because, I'm sure that it's still, even though you would like to think the stigma is not there, it can be in certain areas. So you need to clarify your own values, actually, prior to caring for a patient. You have to be confidential. You can't, run around, I have this HIV-positive person. Same with any other disease, confidentiality. And it's hard to deal with these patients, especially if they're getting at the end of their disease, because they're dying. So now you're caring for a dying patient. Public awareness and education has really helped, along with the medications. The thing is, you want to prevent the disease to begin with. So here's just some of the things, the ABCs of prevention. And this was just in Washington in July, the AIDS quilt. Family members that have lost someone to AIDS, they make squares Some of them make whole big giant quilts, but some of them just make squares. I thought that this was awesome. This was just July, I forget the date, but in DC, and here these quilt travels around the country. So here it is, just people walking around and looking, and you know, family members put things about their loved ones. Questions? Your brains are working. Any questions?